That place now, his brother murmured to himself in his own tongue. Kayla knew that this was the least of the dead. She knew the tactics of defense for Ebenezia. The walls were not secure fortifications, the way they had been in times long ago. As the city had grown in the prosperity of the Midlands Alliance, the older, stronger, fortified walls had been torn down, and the stone used to build these newer, more encompassing outer walls. But they had been built less secure than in the past. They were more a symbol of the size and pride of the Crown City than a strong, defensible perimeter. Under attack, the gates would have been closed, with the toughest, most experienced troops on the outside to stop the attackers before they had a chance to reach the walls. The real defense for Ebenezia was the surrounding mountains, whose narrow passes prevented a broad attack. Under Darkin Rawl's order, Daharan forces had laid siege to Ebenezia for 2 months, but the defenders outside the walls were able to hold them back in the surrounding passes, pin them down, and harry them relentlessly until the attackers finally withdrew, licking their wounds in search of easier prey. Though the Ebenezians had prevailed, it had been at a great cost of lives to the defenders. Had Darkin Rawl been less concerned with finding the boxes, he could have sent greater numbers and maybe overrun the defenders in the passes, but he didn't. This time, someone had. These headless men were a part of that outer defensive ring. Backs to the wall, they had been defeated and captured, and then executed before the walls were breached, apparently as a demonstration to those still inside to terrorize them, to panic them into an ineffectual defense. She knew that what was inside the walls would be worse. The dead women they had been finding told her that much. Out of habit and without even realizing it, she had put on the calm face that showed nothing, the face of a confessor, as her mother had taught her. Prendon, Tossadin, I want you two to go around the outside of the walls. I want to know what else is on the outside. I want to know everything about what has happened here. I want to know when this was done, where the attackers came from, and where they went when they were finished. Chandelin and I will go inside. Meet us back here when you are finished. The brothers went quickly at her direction, their heads close together as they whispered to one another while pointing, analyzing tracks and signs they understood with hardly more than a glance. Chandelin walked silently at her side, his bow with an arrow knocked and tension to the string, at the ready as she stepped over rubble and moved on through the yawning hole. None of the three men had objected to her instructions. They were, she knew, astonished at the size of the city. But more than that, they were overwhelmed at the enormity of what had happened here. They respected her obligation to the dead. Chandelin's eyes ignored the bodies that lay everywhere and watched instead the shaded openings and alleyways among the small daub and wattle houses that were homes to the farmers and sheepherders who had worked the land closer to the city. There were no fresh prints in the snow. Nothing alive had been here recently. Kaelin chose the proper streets, and Chandelin stayed close at her right shoulder, half a step behind. She didn't stop to inspect the dead laying everywhere. All looked to have died the same way, killed in a fierce battle. "These people were defeated by great numbers," Chandelin said in a quiet tone. "Many thousands, as you call it. They had no chance to win." "Why do you say that?" "They are bunched together between the buildings. This is a bad place to have to fight. But in a closed-in place like this, that is the only way. That is the way I would try to defend against a larger number, by blocking the enemy from spreading out behind me to trap me. Greater numbers would not be as much good in the small passageways. I would try to keep the enemy from spreading out and come at them from all sides, so they could not attack as they wished, but must be always in fear of where I would be next. You must not meet the enemy as they wish you to, especially when they greatly outnumber you. There are old men and boys among the soldiers. Boys and old men would not come to fight beside Chandelin unless they saw it was a war to the death and I was greatly outnumbered. For these men to stand and fight against vastly greater numbers, they must have been brave. Old men and boys would not have come to help such brave men if the enemy were not so great. She knew Chandelin was right. Everyone had seen or heard the executions outside the walls. They knew defeat was death. The bodies were felled like reeds before a great wind. As they ascended the rise to where the old city walls had stood, the dead were more numerous. it looked at, they had fallen back, trying to make a stand from higher ground. It had done them no good. They had been overrun. All the dead were defenders. None were the corpses of attackers. Kalin knew that some believed leaving the dead where they fell and defeating an enemy augured ill luck in future battles, and further, that it abandoned their spirits to retribution by the spirits of those defeated. Likewise, they believed that if they left their dead at the site of defeat, the spirits of their fallen comrades would live on to plague their enemies. Whoever had done this must have believed such, and dragged their own dead away from the bodies of those they had vanquished. Kalin knew of several peoples who believed that the act of dying in battle could bring about such thaumaturgy. One nation above all sat at the head of her roster. As they skirted an overturned wagon, its load of firewood spilled in a heap. Chamberlain paused beneath a small wooden sign carved with a leafy plant next to a mortar and pestle. With a hand, he shielded his eyes from the sunlight and looked into the long, narrow shop set back a few feet from the buildings to each side. "What is this place?" Kalin walked past him, through the splintered doorframe. "It's an herb shop." The counter was covered with broken glass jars and dried herbs, all scattered together in a useless mess. Only two glass lids remained unbroken among the pale green debris. This is where people went to get herbs and remedies. Behind the counter, the wall cabinet, which reached from floor to ceiling and almost the entire length of the narrow shop, had held hundreds of small wooden drawers, their patina darkened by the countless touches of fingers. The ones still left in place were smashed in with a mace. The drawers and their contents on the floor had been crushed underfoot. Chamberlain squatted and pulled open the few drawers near the bottom that had remained untouched, inspecting briefly their stores before sliding each drawer closed again. "Nissel would be, how do you say, astonished?" "Astonished," Kalin answered. "She would be astonished to see this many healing plants. This is a crime to destroy things that help people." She watched him pull open drawers and then slide them closed. "A crime," she agreed. He pulled open another drawer and gasped. He squatted, motionless for a moment, before reverently lifting a bundle of miniature plants tied at their stems with a bit of string. The tiny dry leaves were a dusky greenish-brown with crimson veining. A low whistle came from beneath his teeth. "Kwasim Do," he whispered. Kalin eyed the shadowed back of the shop as her vision adjusted to the darkness. She saw no bodies. The proprietor must have fled before he was killed, or maybe he was one who had stood with the army against the invaders. "What is Kwasim Do?" Chamberlain turned the bundle over in his palm, his eyes fixed unblinking on it. "Kwasim Do can save your life if you take 10-step poison by mistake, or if you are quick enough when shot by an arrow with the poison on it." "How can you take it by mistake?" "Many poison bandu leaves must be chewed for a long time and made wet in your mouth before being cooked until they become a thick paste. Sometimes if you swallow some of the wetness in your mouth by accident or chew too long, it can make you sick." He opened a buckskin waist pouch and showed her a small carved bone lidded box. Inside was a dark paste. "This is 10-step poison we put on our arrows. We make it from the bandu. If you ate a very little of this, it would make you sick. If you ate a little more, you would be a long time to die. If you ate more, you would die quick. But no one would eat it after it is made and put in here." He slipped the box of poison back in his pouch. "So you could take some of the Kwasim Do, and it would make you well if you accidentally swallowed some of the bandu when you were chewing its leaves to make the poison?" He nodded in answer to her question. "But if you were shot with a 10-step arrow, wouldn't you die before you could take the Kwasim Do?" Chamberlain turned the bundle of plants in his fingers. "Maybe. Sometimes a man will scratch himself with his own 10-step arrow, but not meaning to, and he can take the Kwasim Do, and he will be well again. If you are shot with a poison arrow, sometimes you will have time to save yourself. 10-step arrows only work quick if you are shot in the neck. Then you have no time to take the Kwasim Do. You will die too quick. But if you are shot in another place, maybe your leg, the poison takes longer to work, and you have time to take the Kwasim Do. What if you aren't near to Nissel, so she could give it to you? You would die if you were out in the plains hunting and you scratched yourself accidentally with a poison arrow. All hunters used to carry a few leaves with them, so they may take it if they scratch themselves, or were shot with an arrow and had time. If there is not much poison on the arrow, like if it has not much on it because it is used to hunt small animals, you have longer. In times long ago, when there was war, our men would swallow kwasin do just before a battle, so the enemy's 10-step arrows would not poison them. He shook his head sadly. But this is much trouble to get. The last time we traded for this much, every man in the village had to make 3 bows and 2 fists of arrows, and all the women had to make bowls. It's gone now, for a long time, years. The people we traded with have been able to find no more. 2 men have died since we no longer have it. My people would trade much to have this much again. Kalin stood over him, watching him gently place it back in the drawer. Take it, Chandelin. Give it to your people. They have need of it. He slowly slid the drawer closed. I cannot. It would be wrong to take it from another people, even if they are dead. It does not belong to my people. It belongs to the people here. Kalin squatted down next to him, pulled open the drawer, and lifted out the little bundle. She found a square of cloth lying on the floor nearby, used for packaging purchases, and wrapped the kwasin do plants. Take it. She pushed the bundle into his hand. I know the people of this city. I will repay them for what I have taken. Since I will pay for it, it belongs to me now. Take it. It is my gift for the trouble I have caused your people. He stared at the cloth parcel in his hand. It is too valuable for a gift. A gift of such great value would bind us to an obligation to you. Then it is not a gift, but my payment to you and Prindon and Tossadin for guarding me on this journey. You 3 are risking your lives to protect me. That is a debt I owe you that is greater than this payment. You will owe me no more obligation. With a frown, he studied the bundle a moment, and then bounced it twice in his hand before tucking it in the buckskin pouch at his waist. He tied the flap closed by its rawhide thong and stood. Then this is in trade for what we do. We owe you no obligation beyond this journey. None, she said, sealing the bargain. The 2 of them walked on through the silent streets, past the shops and inns of the old city quarter. Every door, every window was broken in. Shards of glass sparkled in the sunlight, shimmering tears for the dead. The invading horde had swept through every building, searching out anything alive. How do this many thousands, all living in this one place, find land to feed their families? There could not be enough game to hunt or fields for all to plant. Kalin tried to see the city through his eyes. It must be a great puzzle to him. They don't all hunt or plant the land. The people who lived here specialized. Specialized? What is this? It means that different people have different jobs. They work at one thing. They use silver or gold to buy the things they need that they don't grow or make themselves. Where do they get this silver or gold? People who want the thing they specialize in pay for it with silver or gold. And where do these others get this silver or gold? They get it from people who pay them for the things they do. Chandelin looked at her skeptically. Why do they not trade? It would be easier to trade. Well, in a way it is trading. Often the person who wants what you have has nothing you want, so they give you money. Silver or gold made into flat round discs called coins instead. Then you can use the money to buy things you need. Buy? Chandelin seemed to test the strange word with his tongue as he looked off down a street to their right while shaking his head in disbelief. Why would people work then? Why would they not just go and get this silver or gold money? Some do. They hunt silver and gold, but that is hard work too. Gold is hard to find and dig out of the ground. That is why it is used for money, because it is rare. If it were easy to find, like grains of sand, then no one would take it in trade. If money were easy to get or to make, it would become worthless, and then in the end this system of trade, with worthless money, would fail, and everyone would starve. He came to a halt with a frown. What is this money made from? What is this silver or gold you speak of? She didn't stop with him, and he had to take a few bounding steps to catch back up with her. Gold is the medallion, the necklace that the Bontoc gave as a gift to the Mud People to show they did not wish to make war, that is made of gold. Chandelin nodded with a knowing grunt. Kalin halted this time. Do you know where the Bontoc got that much gold? Chandelin swept his gaze across the slate rooftops. Of course. They got it from us. Kalin gripped his arm covered with his mantle and pulled him around. What do you mean they got it from you? He tensed at her touch. He didn't like her hand, a confessor's hand, on him. That the fur mantle separated actual contact of flesh was of no consequence. Their flesh was close enough. If she relaxed her restraint of the power, that thin piece of hide would be no impediment. Kalin had loosed her power through armor before. She released her grip, and he visibly relaxed. Chandelin, where did the Mud People get that much gold? He looked at her, as if she were a child asking where you might find dirt. From the holes in the ground. In our land to the north, where it is rocky and nothing much will grow or live, there are holes in the ground. They have this gold in them. It is a bad place. The air is hot and bad. It is said that men die if they stay too long in the ground. The yellow metal is in these deep holes. It is too soft to make good weapons, so it is of no use. He dismissed its importance with a wave of his hand. But the Bontoc say their ancestors' spirits like the look of the yellow metal, and so we let them come onto our land and go into the holes so they may get it to make things their ancestors' spirits may like to look upon when they come to this world. Chandelin, do others know of these holes in the ground of the gold that is in them? He shrugged. We do not let outsiders come to our land, but I told you, it is too soft to make weapons with, so it is of no use. It pleases the Bontoc, and they are good traders with us, so we let them take what they want. They do not take much, though, because it is a bad place to go into. No one would want to go there except the Bontoc, to please their ancestors' spirits. How could she explain it to him? He didn't understand the ways of the outside world. Chandelin, you must never use this gold. He made a face that said he had already explained how useless it was, and no one would want it. You may think it is useless, but others would kill to get it. If people knew you had gold on your land, they would swarm over you to get it. The craving for gold makes men crazy, and they would do anything to get it. They would kill Mud People. Chandelin straightened with a smug expression. He took his hand from the bowstring and tapped his chest. I and my men protect our people. We would keep the outsiders away. Kalin swept her arm around, taking in the hundreds upon hundreds of dead around her. Against this many? Against thousands? Chandelin had never seen this many people. He understood little of the numbers that lived outside his lands. Thousands who would never stop coming until they swept you aside? His eyes followed the arc her arm had taken, his brow wrinkled with the frown of a worry unfamiliar to him, his arrogance evaporating as he took in the dead. Our ancestors' spirits have warned us not to speak of the holes in the ground with the bad air. We only let the Bontoc go there, no one else. See that it stays that way, she said, or they will come and steal it. That would be wrong, to steal from a people. He put renewed tension to the bowstring as she let out a noisy breath of frustration. If I make a bow to trade, everyone knows it is the work of Chandelin, because it is such a fine bow. If anyone steals it, everyone knows what it is and where it came from, and the thief would be caught and be made to give it back. Maybe he would be sent away from his people. How do these people tell who the money belongs to if it is taken by a thief? Kalin's mind reeled from the effort of trying to explain such things to Chandelin. At least it was keeping her from having to think about the dead all about her. She started walking again through the snow, having to step over a man's back because there was no way around. They were fallen so close. It is difficult. Because of this, people guard their money. If anyone is caught stealing, the punishment is severe, to discourage thieving. How are thieves punished? If they didn't steal much and are lucky, they might be locked in a small room until their families can make reparations for what they stole. Locked? What is this? A lock is a way of barring a door. The stone rooms that thieves are placed in have a door they are not able to open from the inside. It has a lock on it, and you must have a key, the right key, to open it, so they cannot get out. Chandelin checked a side street beyond a silversmith's shop as they continued up the main road. "I would rather be put to death than be locked in a room. If the thief stole from the wrong person or is unlucky, that is what happens to him." Chandelin grunted. She didn't think she was doing a very good job of explaining things to him. He seemed to think the whole scheme unworkable. "Our way is better. We make what we want. Everyone makes what they need. This specializing way is not our way. We trade only for a few things. Our way is better." "You do the same as these people, Chandelin. You may not realize it, but you do." "No. Each person knows many things. We teach all our children to know how to do everything they need. You specialize. You're a hunter, and more than that, you're a protector to your people." She nodded once again to the dead around her. Some stared back with flat eyes. These men were soldiers. They specialized at protecting their people. They gave their lives trying to protect their people. You're the same as they. A soldier. You're strong. You are good with a bow and spear. And you are good at discovering and preparing to thwart the various ways others would try to harm your people. Chandelin thought this over a moment, as he stopped briefly to knock a heavy clump of snow from the binding of his snowshoes. "But that is only me, because I am so strong and wise. Others of my people do not specialize." "Everyone specializes, Chandelin. Nissel, the healer, she specializes at helping sick or injured people. She spends most of her time helping others. How does she feed herself?" "Though she helps give her what she needs, and if there is no one to help so she can be offered food by them, then others who have enough offer some of theirs so Nissel will be well fed and ready to help us. You see, though she helps pay her with tava bread, but it's the same thing, almost, as they do here with money, because she specializes in a service to the village. Everyone helps a little so she will be there for the village when there is need of her. Here, that's called a tax, when everyone pays a little toward the good of the group to help support those who work for all the people." "Is this how you get your food? The people all give for you, like we do when you come to make trouble for us?" She was relieved that for the first time he didn't say it with enmity. "Yes." Chandelin eyed empty second-floor windows as they walked on among the buildings that were becoming larger and more ornate. The double, iron-strap-hinged doors to an inn on their left were broken in, and tables, chairs, pots, dishes, and linen embroidered with red roses, apparently to echo the inn's name, the Red Rose, had been thrown into the street, where they were half covered over with the snow. Through the empty doorway, she could see the body of an apron-clad kitchen boy sprawled on the floor, his eyes staring up at the ceiling, frozen with the terror of his last vision. He couldn't have been over 12. "But that is just the hunters and Nissel," Chandelin added, after some thought. "Others of us do not do this specializing." "Everyone does, to some degree. The women bake the tava bread. The men make the weapons. Nature is that way, too. Some plants grow where it is wet, some where it is dry. Some animals eat grass, some leaves, some bugs, and some other animals. Everything plays its part. Women have the babies, and men..." She halted, fists at her sides, staring at the countless bodies fallen all around her. She swept her arm out. "And men, it would seem, are here to kill everything. You see, Chandelin? Women's specialty is to bring forth life, and men's specialty is to take it away." Kaelin clenched her fist against her stomach. She was dangerously close to losing her composure. Nausea swept through her. Her head spun. Chandelin stole a glimpse at her from the corner of his eye. "The birdman would say not to judge all by what some do. And women do not make life alone. Men are part of that, too." Kaelin gulped cold air. With a struggle, she started off again, shuffling her snowshoes ahead. Chandelin let her set a quicker pace as he walked beside her. She turned them up a street lined with fine shops. As she moved up and then down a snowdrift, he pointed with his bow, seeming to look for an excuse to change the subject. "Why do they have wooden people here?" A headless mannequin rested at an angle against a windowsill, tipped halfway out of a shop. The elaborate blue dress the mannequin wore was trimmed with white beads draped in layers about the waist. Glad to have a diversion from the thoughts swirling in her head, Kaelin changed direction a little toward the mannequin in the blue dress. This is a tailor shop. The people who owned this shop specialized in making clothes. This wooden person is simply a form to display what they make, so others may know the fine work they do. It's a demonstration of pride in their work. She stopped before the large window. All the panes of glass were broken out. A few of the yellow-painted mullions hung crookedly from the top of the frame. The shade of blue of the gorgeous gown reminded Kaylin of her wedding dress. She could feel the blood pounding in the veins of her neck as she swallowed back a cry. Chandelin watched both directions, up and down the street, as her hand slowly reached out to touch the frozen, blue fabric. Her vision focused past the mannequin, into the shop, where a square of sunlight fell across the snow-dusted floor and up and over a low work counter. Her hand faltered. A dead man with a balding head was pinned to the wall by a spear through his chest. A woman lay sprawled face down over the counter, her dress and underskirts bunched up around her waist, exposing blue flesh. A pair of tailor's scissors jutted from her back. In the gloom at the far end of the room stood another mannequin in a fine man's coat. The front of the dark coat was shredded with hundreds of small cuts. The soldiers had evidently used the mannequin as a target for knife throwing while they waited their turn on the woman. Apparently, when they were finished with her, they stabbed her to death with her scissors. Kaylin twisted away from the shop to find herself face to face with Chandelin. His was red. There was menace in his eyes. "Not all men are the same. I would cut the throat of any man of mine if he did such a thing." Kaylin had no answer for him, and suddenly wasn't in the mood to talk. As she started off again, she loosened the mantle at her neck, needing the feel of cold air. In silence, but for the low, baleful moan of the breeze between the buildings, they slogged past stables of horses, their throats all cut, and past inns and grand houses, their cornices high overhead, shading them from the bright, slanting sunlight. Fluted wooden columns to each side of one door had been hacked at with a sword, seemingly for no purpose but to deface the elegance of the home. It was colder in the shade, but she didn't care. They stepped over corpses that lay face down in the snow, with wounds in their backs, and around overturned wagons and coaches and dead horses and dead dogs. It all melted into a meaningless madness of destruction. Eyes cast to the ground before her, she trudged on through the snow. The cold air bit into her flesh, and she pulled her mantle closed once more. The cold was sapping her of not only warmth, but strength. With grim determination, she put one foot in front of the other, continuing on toward her destination, hoping somehow that she would never reach it. With the frozen dead of Ebenezia all around, she filled her crushing loneliness with a silent prayer. "Please, dear spirits, keep Richard warm." Chapter 28. Naked, under the sun's fury, the parched, dead-flat ground stretched endlessly before them, in the distance offering up shimmering images to waver and dance in the sun's furnace glare, like phantom hostages surrendered to an omnipotent foe. Behind, the fractured hills ended in a bank of rocky rubble. The silence was as oppressive as the heat. Richard wiped sweat from his brow on the back of his sleeve. The leather of his saddle creaked as he shifted his weight while he waited. Bonnie and the other two horses waited too, their ears pricked ahead, as they occasionally pawed the cracked, dry earth and voiced apprehensive snorts. Sister Verna sat motionless atop Jessup, scrutinizing the nothingness of the distance as if viewing an event of great import. Except for the way her brown curls hung limp, she didn't appear to be affected by the heat. "I don't understand this weather. It's winter. I've never heard of it being hot like this in winter." "The weather is different in different places," she murmured. "No, it's not. When it's winter, it's cold. It's only hot like this in high summer. Have you ever seen snow on mountaintops in the summer?" Richard reversed the positions of his hands resting on the pommel. "Yes, but that's just on mountaintops. The air is colder up there. We're not on a mountaintop." She did not move. "Not just mountaintops have different weather. In the south, the weather is not so cold as it is in the north. But this place is different still. It's like an inexhaustible well of heat." "And just what is this place?"
"The Valley of the Lost," she whispered.
"Who was lost in it?"
"Those who created it, and whoever enters." At last she turned a bit to peer at him. "It's the end of the world. Your world, anyway." He shifted his way to the other side when Bonnie did the same. "If it's the end of the world, why are we here?" Sister Verna held her hand up to the land behind. "Just as there is Westland, where you were born, separated from the Midlands and the Midlands from Dahara, so too are those lands separated from what lies on the far side of this place." Richard frowned. "And what lies on the other side of here?" She turned back to the expanse before them. "You lived in the New World. Across this valley lies the Old World."
"The Old World?"
"I never heard of the Old World." "Few in the New World have. It's been sealed away and forgotten. This valley, the Valley of the Lost, separates them, much the same way the boundary used to separate the three lands of the New World. The last of the country we have been crossing has been inhospitable. A desert wasteland. Anyone venturing through it, into this valley, never returns. People think there is nothing beyond, that this is the southern end of the Midlands and Dahara, with nothing beyond but what you see here, an endless waste, where one could die of thirst and hunger, and you could have your bones baked by the heat of the sun." Richard eased Bonnie up next to the sister. "So what is beyond, and why can't anyone cross? And if no one can cross, how can we?" She looked over out of the corner of her eye. Simple questions, but not simply answered. She relaxed back in her saddle a little. "The land between the new and the old worlds narrows somewhat, with the sea to each side."
"The sea?
You have never seen the ocean?"
Richard shook his head. "In Westland, it lies far to the south, and people don't live there. Or so I've been told. I've heard others speak of the ocean, but I've never seen it. They say it's more vast than any lake ever imagined."
Sister Verna gave him a little smile. "They speak true." She turned ahead, pointing off to the right. "Some distance that way lies the sea." She pointed left, to the southeast. "Off even farther in that direction is also the sea." "Though the land is vast between them, it is still the narrowest place between the new and the old worlds. Because of that, a war was fought here, a war between wizards."
Richard straightened in his saddle. "Wizards? What war?"
"Yes, wizards. It was ages ago, when there were many wizards. What you see before you is the result of that war. It's all that remains as a reminder of what wizards who have more power than wisdom can conjure." He didn't like the accusing look she gave him.
"Who won?"
At last she folded her hands over the pommel of her saddle and let her shoulders relax a bit. "No one. The two sides were separated by this land between the seas. Though the fighting may have stopped, no one prevailed."
Richard leaned around for a water skin. "How about a drink?"
With a small smile, she took the skin as he handed it over and took a long draw. "This valley is an example of what can happen when your heart, rather than your head, rules your magic." Her smile evaporated. "Because of what they did, the peoples of the two worlds are separated for all time. It is one reason the Sisters of the Light work to teach those with the gift, so they will not act out of foolishness."
"What were they fighting about?"
"What do wizards ever fight about? They fought over which wizard should rule.
I was told something about a wizard's war, over whether or not wizards should rule at all."
She handed back the water skin and wiped her lips with one finger. "That was a different war, yet part of the same. After this place separated the two sides, some of each camp were trapped on the New World side. Both groups had gone to enforce their rule on those who had traveled to live in the New World, and on those who had always lived there. Once trapped, one side went into hiding for centuries and worked to build their strength before they attempted to seize power over all the New World. The war that had burned long ago flared again, until their force was defeated, except for a few who fled into the stronghold in Dahara." She lifted an eyebrow to him. "Kin of yours, I believe." Richard glared at her for a long moment before finally taking a swig of the hot water. He dribbled a little on a strip of cloth, something Kaelin had taught him, and tied it around his head, both to cool his brow and hold back his lengthening hair. Richard hooked the water skin back on his saddle.
"So what happened here?"
She swept her hand once from the southeast to the southwest. "Where the land was narrowest, here, not only armies but wizards did battle, and sought to prevent one another from advancing. The wizards laid down spells conjuring every sort of magic in an attempt to snare their opponents. both sides equally unleashed wickedness of unspeakable horror and danger. That is what lies ahead.
Richard stared at her glazed expression. You mean to say that their magic, their spells, are still out there?
Unabated.
How can that be? Wouldn't they wear away, fade?
Perhaps,
she sighed.
But they did more.
To maintain the power of their spells, they built structures to sustain the force. What structures could do that? Sister Verna still stared out at nothing, or perhaps to things he couldn't see.
The Towers of Perdition, she whispered.
Richard stroked Bonnie's neck and waited. At last, Sister Verna seemed to dismiss her private thoughts with a deep breath and continued.
From one sea to the other, both sides built opposing lines of these towers, invested with their power and wizardry. They were begun at the sea and came together here in this valley. But because of the force of the towers each side built, neither side could get close enough to complete the last tower in their own line. What they had wrought ended in a stalemate, with each side prevented from completing their last tower. It allowed a weakened place in the magic, a gap.
Richard shifted uneasily in his saddle. If there's a gap, then why can't people cross?
It's only a lessening in the full strength of the line. To each side, all the way across the hills and mountains, to Land's End and beyond, out into the sea where it somewhere diminishes, Perdition's line is impenetrable. To enter is to be claimed by the storms of spells, the magic. Any who enter would be killed or worse. They could wander the broom forever. Here in this valley, the deadlock prevented the completion of the last tower on each side that would have sealed the line. But the spells wander and drift between the gap, like thunderclouds drifting on the wind, clashing and coming together in places. Because of the weakness in this place, there is a maze that can be passed through by those with the gift. The clear passages are always shifting, and the spells cannot always be seen. They must be felt with the gift. Still, it is not easy.
So that's why the Sisters of the Light can make it through, because they have the gift?
Yes. But only twice at most. The magic learns to find you. Long ago, sisters who went through to the new world and returned were sent again, but none ever returned a second time.
Her gaze left his, seeking the distant emptiness.
They are in there, never to be found or saved. The Towers of Perdition and its storms of magic claimed them.
Richard waited until her eyes came back to him. Perhaps, sister, they became disaffected and chose not to return. How would you know?
Her expression sobered. We know. Some who have been through have seen them.
She inclined her head toward the shimmering distance.
In there, I myself saw several.
I'm sorry, Sister Verna. Richard thought about Zed. Kaelin might find him and tell him what had happened. He had to push away the painful memory of Kaelin. So a wizard could make it through.
Not a wizard of his full power. After we teach those with the gift to control it, they must be allowed to return before their power is fully developed. The whole purpose of the line is to prevent wizards from getting through. The fully developed power of a wizard would draw the spells as a magnet draws iron filings. It is they that the magic seeks. It is for them that the towers were built. They would be lost, just as would anyone who didn't have some use of the gift to fill the gaps in the spells. Too little or too much, and you are lost. That is why those who created the line could not complete it. The domain of the spells from the other side prevented them from entering. Their creation ended in a deadlock.
Richard felt his hopes sag. If Kaelin carried out his request to seek out his old friend, Zed could not do anything to help him. Swallowing back the numbing loss of hope, he reached up and felt the dragon's tooth hanging on the leather thong at his chest. What about going over? Could something fly over?
She shook her head. The spells extend up into the air, as they extend out into the sea. Anything that can fly cannot fly high enough.
What about the sea? Could you sail far enough out to go around?
Sister Verna shrugged. I have heard tell that a few times throughout the ages it has been accomplished. In my life I have seen ships leave to attempt it, but I have never seen one return.
Richard glanced back over his shoulder but saw nothing. Could someone follow you through?
One or two, if they stayed close enough, as you must. Greater numbers would surely be lost. The pockets between spells are not large enough to allow many to follow. Richard thought in silence, at last asking, "Why hasn't anyone destroyed the towers, so the spells could dissipate?"
"We've tried. It cannot be done."
"Just because you haven't found a way, sister, that doesn't mean it can't be done."
She gave him a sharp look. The towers and the spells were created with the aid of not only additive, but also subtractive magic.
Subtractive magic? How could the wizards of old have learned to use subtractive magic? Wizards didn't have command of subtractive magic, but then Darkenrall did.
Richard gentled his tone. How can the towers keep the spells from dissipating? Sister Verna worked her thumbs on the reins. Each tower has a wizard's life force in it.
Despite the heat, Richard felt a chill. You mean to say that a wizard gave his life force into the towers?
Worse, each tower contains the life force of many wizards.
Richard stared in numb shock at the thought of wizards giving up their lives to invest the towers with their life force.
How close are the towers?
It is said some are miles apart, some only yards. They are spaced according to the fabric of lines of power within the earth itself. We don't understand the sense of this alignment, since entering the line to find them would be death. We don't even know how many towers there are. We know of only the few in this valley.
Richard squirmed in his saddle. Will we see any of the towers when we cross?
There is no way to tell. The gaps shift constantly. Occasionally on the way through, the openings take you close to a tower. I saw one on my first journey through. Some sisters never saw one. I hope never to see another.
Richard realized he was gripping the hilt of his sword with his left hand. The raised letters of the word truth bit into his flesh. He relaxed his hand, releasing the hilt.
So what can we expect to see?
Sister Verna broke her gaze into the distance and redirected it to him.
There are spells of every sort. Some are spells of despair. To be snared in one is to have your soul wander in despair for all time. Some are spells of joy and delight in which one is lost in enchantment for all time. Some are pure destruction and will tear you apart. Some will show you things you fear to make you run into the clutches of things that lurk behind. Some tempt with things you hope for. If you give in to the desire...
She leaned closer to him.
You must stay close to me. Keep going. You must ignore any desire you have, both fear and longing, to do otherwise. Do you understand?
Richard finally nodded. Sister Verna returned her gaze to the shimmering forms. She sat motionless, watching. In the distance, beyond the wavering light, he thought he saw thunderheads, dark and ominous, drifting across the horizon. He felt more than heard their thunder. Somehow, he knew it wasn't clouds but magic. When Bonnie tossed her head, Richard gave her a reassuring pat on her neck. After watching a while, he looked over to the sister. She sat still and tense.
What are you waiting for, sister? Courage?
She answered without moving.
Exactly. I am waiting for courage, child.
He felt no anger this time at her calling him child, but rather that it might be an appropriate characterization as far as his abilities were concerned. In a whisper and still without looking away from the sun-baked inferno ahead, she went on.
You were still in swaddling clothes when I came through, but I remember every detail as if it happened yesterday. Yes, I am waiting for courage.
He gave Bonnie a squeeze with his legs, urging her ahead. The sooner we start, the sooner we're through.
Or lost.
She walked her horse after him.
So anxious to be lost, Richard?
I'm already lost, sister.
Chapter 29. They were confronted by steps, 20 strides wide, that revealed themselves for what they were only at the far right, where the wind had funneled down next to the sweeping pink marble balustrade and kept the snow clear. Pausing for only a moment as she realized they had reached her destination, Kaelin set her snowshoes firmly into the snowdrift that covered the steps and ascended to the portico, its fascia decorated with a row of statues swathed in cut stone that mimicked the drape of cloth so well it seemed as if it might move in the light breeze. 10 white columns to each side held a massive entablature at a dizzying height above the arched entrance. Bodies fallen in a desperate battle,
were sprawled atop one another all over the snow-covered lawns, and sat as if in repose against the walls of the domed exterior entrance hall. The ornate doors, displaying delicately carved royal shields of the House of Amnell, held aloft by twin mountain lions, lay in splinters on the floor of the vestibule. Flanking the rope-carved stone arch at the far end stood life-size statues of Queen Bernadine and King Wyborn, each holding a spear and shield in one hand, the queen a sheaf of wheat in the other, and the king a lamb. The queen's breasts were broken away. Flakes of stone and stone dust littered the rust-colored marble tiles. Both statues were without their heads. With nearly numb fingers, Kaelin untied the bindings of her snowshoes and leaned them against the queen's statue. Chandelin followed her example before following her into the reception hall, lined with broken mirrors and torn tapestries. She pulled her mantle tight around herself as clouds of their breath rose lazily into dead, still air that was somehow much colder than that outside. "What is this place used for?" Chandelin asked in a whisper, as if afraid he might wake the spirits of the dead. She had to force herself not to whisper. "It is the home of the queen of this land. Her name is Cirilla." His doubting voice echoed down the stone hall. "One person lives in a place such as this?" "Many people live here. There are advisors, much like the elders among your people, and others that are responsible for governing the needs of the land and people who tend to their needs so they may perform their duties. Many people call this their home, but the queen is the head of the household, as she is the head of her land. She is above them all." Chandelin followed silently as she began to search the palace. His eyes slid from one wondrous object to another, from elaborately carved furniture that now lay everywhere in splinters, to the heavy red, blue, gold, or green draperies that adorned the 10-foot-tall square-top windows, all broken now. She descended a flight of stairs to the lower rooms, the oak treads creaking with every step in the cold. He insisted on entering each room first, pushing doors open with a foot and gliding in behind a fully drawn 10-step arrow, before allowing her to search inside. They found only the dead. In a few of the rooms they found some of the staff, who had been lined up against a wall and pin-cushioned with arrows. In the kitchens it looked as if, after executing the cooks, cook's helpers, wine stewards, assistants, dishwashers, pot boys, spit boys, and scullions, the invaders had sat down and had a drunken feast. The ale and wine casks were empty. It appeared they had thrown more food at the walls than they had eaten. While Chandelin checked the ransacked larder, Kaelin's eye was caught by the bodies of two young women, kitchen help, on the floor behind a long chopping block. One was completely naked, and the other had but one brown woolen stocking bunched down around her thin ankle. Her first assumption had been wrong. Not all the help had been killed before the drunken feast. Her face as still as those of the dead women, she turned and strode from the kitchen and started up the servant stairs to check the upper floors. Chandelin's thumping footfalls came charging up behind as he took three steps at a time to catch her. She knew he didn't like it that she had left without him, but he didn't voice it. "There is salted meat. Maybe we could take a little? I do not think these people would think it wrong for us to do so. They would not deny us a little food." Kaelin put her hand to the railing as she climbed with a steady cadence, but then pulled the hand back inside her mantle because the polished maple was so cold to the touch it stung her fingers. "If you eat the meat, you will die. They will have poisoned it, so that if any of the dead's countrymen return to this place and eat any of the food here, they too will die." They found the main floor clear of bodies. It looked to have been used as an army headquarters. Empty barrels of wine and rum lay about the ballroom floor. Food scraps, mugs and cups, broken dishes, pipe ashes, bloody bandages, oily rags, broken or bent swords, spears and maces, dark wood shavings from a walnut table leg someone had whittled away until it was nothing but a stub, basins of frozen water, dirty linen, bedsheets ripped into strips, and filthy quilted bedcovers of every color littered the carpeted floor. Dirty boot prints were everywhere, even on the tabletops. By the swirling scratches, it looked as if men had danced atop them. Chandelin walked through the rubble, inspecting various bits.
2, maybe 3 days they were here. She nodded her agreement as her eyes cast about.
It looks that way.
He rolled a wine barrel back and forth with his foot, testing if it was empty. It was.
I wonder why they stayed so long, just to drink and dance?
Kaelin sighed.
I don't know. Maybe they were resting and tending to their wounded. Maybe they just went on a drunken binge to celebrate their victory over these people.
He looked up sharply. Killing is not a thing to celebrate.
It is for the people who did this killing.
Reluctantly, Kaelin at last climbed the stairs to the top floor. She didn't want to look up there. That was where the bedchambers were. They checked the west wing first, the men's apartments. They looked to have been used by the troops as sleeping quarters. With an army of as many men as had to have done this, they would have had many men of rank. The officers probably stayed here in the fine rooms. The soldiers under their command would have used the inns and more common houses. With a deep breath to strengthen her resolve, she set her jaw and crossed the central hall, with its balcony that overlooked the grand staircase, to the east wing rooms. Chamberlain, close at her heels, wanted to open the doors for her and check the rooms first, but here she wouldn't allow it. Her hand paused for a moment on the doorknob, then finally opened the first door. She stood for a time, staring at the scene inside. She went to the next door and flung it open, and then to the next. All the rooms were occupied. Each bedchamber had women in it, none clothed. Room after room after room were all the same. By the filthy condition of the carpets, there looked to have been a steady stream of traffic. Wood shavings lay in little piles about the floor, where a man had passed the time whittling on whatever was handy while he waited his turn.
Now we know why they spent several days here, Kaelin said without meeting Chamberlain's eyes.
He remained silent. She couldn't bring forth more than a whisper.
So they could do this.
Those few days had undoubtedly been the longest of these women's lives. Kaelin prayed that their spirits were at peace now. She reached the door at the end, the door to the room the younger women shared. Slowly she opened it and stood looking in, Chamberlain close behind her, looking past her shoulder. Stifling a gasp, she turned and put a hand to his chest.
Please, Chamberlain, wait here.
He nodded as he furiously studied his boots. Kaelin closed the door behind herself and stood with her back against it for a time. One hand at her side, and the other covering her mouth, she skirted an overturned, wrecked wardrobe and walked the length of the frigid room, between the rows of beds, looking from one side to the other. The precious hand mirrors, brushes, combs, and pins that at one time had been arranged with loving care on tables between the beds now lay scattered about the floor. The blue moire curtains billowed slightly in the icy air coming through the broken windows. These were the queen's ladies-in-waiting, young women of 14, 15, and 16, a few a little older. These were not just nameless corpses. Kaelin knew many of these young women. The queen had taken them with her when she had traveled to Adendril to speak before the council. Kaelin could not have failed to notice them, their vibrancy, their wide-eyed excitement at being in Adendril. Seeing the grandeur of Adendril through their young eyes had given Kaelin new vision of the things around her and brought a smile to her lips. She had longed to give them a tour personally, but being with the Mother Confessor would have frightened them, and so she hadn't. But she had admired them from afar and envied their lives of possibility. Kaelin stopped at various beds, her back stiff, her head held high, her jaw rigid, as she reluctantly cast her eyes down at faces she knew. Juliana, one of the youngest, had always been self-confident and assertive. She knew what she wanted and wasn't timid about going after it. She had always been smitten with young men in uniform, soldiers. One time, it had brought her to grief with her chaperone, Mistress Nelda. Kaelin had surreptitiously interceded on her behalf, informing Mistress Nelda that despite Juliana's dalliances, the Adendril Home Guard were all men of impeccable honor and would never lay a finger on a queen's lady. Her wrists were now tied to the headpost, and by the way they had bled, looked to have been that way through the whole of her ordeal. Kaelin silently cursed the spirits for their cruel humor
in giving the young innocent what she had thought she wanted. Little Ellsworth was in the next blood-soaked bed. Her breasts had been stabbed countless times, and her throat slit, as were many of the rest, like hogs at slaughter. At the end of the room, Kaylin stopped at the foot of the last bed. Ashley, one of the older teenagers, had each ankle tied to a footpost. She had been strangled with a curtain tieback. Her father was one of the Galleon aides to the ambassador in Adendrill. Her mother had been thrilled to tears when Queen Cirilla had agreed to take Ashley on as one of her ladies-in-waiting. How would she ever find the words to tell Ashley's father and mother what had happened to their little girl while in the service of their queen? As Kaylin retraced her steps through the length of the room, taking a last look at each dead body, at each face frozen in horror or in blank submission, she idly wondered why she wasn't crying. Shouldn't she cry? Shouldn't she fall to her knees, scream in anguish, pound her fists, and cry until she drowned in tears? But she didn't. She felt as if there were no tears to be had. Perhaps there were too many. Perhaps she had seen so many that day that it had simply numbed her to it, like when you get into a tub of hot water for a bath, and at first you feel that it is too hot to stand, that surely you are being scalded, but after a few minutes, it seems only warm. She softly pulled the door closed. Chandelin stood in the exact same spot she had left him. His knuckles were white on his bow. Kaylin walked past him, expecting him to follow. He didn't. "Most women would cry," he said as he stared at the door. She felt a flush of heat in her cheeks. "I am not most women." Chandelin didn't take his eyes from the door. "No, you are not." His eyes finally left the door to look down at his bow. The tension left his shoulders as he pulled a deep breath, as if it was the first he had taken in a while. "I wish to tell you a story." Kaylin waited a few paces away. "I do not wish to hear a story right now, Chandelin. Perhaps later." He turned his fierce brown eyes to her. "I wish to tell you a story," he repeated, a little louder this time. She sighed. "If it's important to you, then tell me." Holding her gaze, he closed the distance between them. He was a scant inch shorter than she, but right then he looked taller to her. "When my grandfather was as young and strong," he tapped his puffed-up chest, "as I am now, he already had a wife and two sons. Many peoples came to our village to trade. We let all come. We kept no one away. All were welcome. The Jacopo were one of these people who came to trade." "Who are the Jacopo?" Kaylin knew every people in the Midlands, but had never heard of these. "People who lived to the west, closer to where the boundary was." Kaylin frowned as her mind searched a mental map. "No one lives to the west of the Mud People. That land is deserted." Chandelin watched her from under his eyebrows. "The Jacopo were big people." He held his hand a head higher than he was before letting it fall to his side. "But they were always peaceful, like the Bontoc, like our people. Then they made war on us. We do not know the reason, but our people were very afraid. They would shake at night in the fear that the Jacopo might come again the next day. They would come to our village and cut the men's throats and take women and do these things to them." He flicked his hand self-consciously at the door. "Rape," she said in an even tone. "It is called rape." He nodded. "The Jacopo would do this to our women. They stole many women and did this rape to them." He glanced at the door again. "In the way it was done to these women. Do you understand?" "They were raped by many men and tortured and murdered." He nodded, relieved that he didn't have to elaborate. "The Mud People did not have fighters, like we do now, like me." His chest swelled again, and his chin came up. At last, the wind left his lungs. "We never had to fight with anyone. None of our people wanted to fight others. They thought it was wrong. But the Jacopo made us want to fight. They stole my grandmother, my grandfather's wife, the mother to my father. My grandfather gave an oath to send the Jacopo to the spirit world. He gathered men together,
men who had their wives or sisters or mothers taken and...
He wiped his forehead, as if he were sweating, but in the cold he was not. Kalin put a hand on his arm. He didn't flinch this time.
I understand, Chandelin.
My grandfather called for a gathering, and was visited by our ancestors' spirits. He wept for his wife before the spirits, and asked if the ancestors' spirits would teach him how to stop the Jacopo. They told him that first he must stop weeping until after the fighting was done.
Kalin took her hand back and absently stroked the fur at her neck. My father taught me something very much like that. He said, don't shed tears over those already in the ground until you have brought vengeance to those who put them there. There will be time enough then.
Chandelin appraised her approvingly. Then your father was a wise man.
Kalin waited silently until at last he seemed to mentally gather up the memories of the stories and go on.
The ancestors' spirits came to my grandfather every night in a gathering. They taught him what he must do, how to kill. He taught these men what he had learned. He taught them how to put mud on themselves and tie grass to themselves so not to be seen. Our men became like shadows. The Jacopo could not see them if they stood as close as we do now. My grandfather and his men made war with the Jacopo. Not war the way the Jacopo made war, but the way the spirits taught. The Jacopo made war in the day because they were many and had no fear of us. The spirits told grandfather that he must not fight the Jacopo the way they wanted, but must make them fear the night and the empty grassland and every call of a bird or frog or bug. For every one of the mud people, there were 5 Jacopo. At first, they were not afraid of us because of their numbers. We killed Jacopo when they hunted food, when they tended their crops, and when they cared for their animals, when they went for water, when they went to squat, when they slept, any Jacopo, every Jacopo. We did not try to fight them. We only killed them. Until there were no more Jacopo in this world. Only in the spirit world. She wondered briefly if he meant that they had killed the children too, but she knew the answer. There were no more Jacopo. Something else her father had taught her came to mind. If war is brought to you, then it is incumbent upon you to show no mercy. Surely you will be shown none, and you will be a traitor to your people and as good as their enemy if you let any clemency slip its bounds, for your people will pay for your mistake with their lives.
I understand, Chandelin. Your people did the only thing they could. Your grandfather did what was necessary to protect his people. My father also taught me, if war is brought to you, then let there be war like your enemy has never imagined in his most frightening nightmares. Anything less, and you hand victory to your foe.
Your father, too, must know the spirits of his ancestors. He did well to teach you their lessons.
His voice lowered sympathetically.
But I know they are harsh lessons to live by, and can make you look hard to others.
I know the truth of that. Your grandfather brought honor to the mud people, Chandelin. I'm sure that when it was done, he shed many tears for those of his people who were murdered.
Chandelin untied the thong at his neck and shrugged back his mantle, letting it drop to the floor. He wore a heavy buckskin tunic and pants, at each shoulder. Held with a band made of woven prairie cotton around his upper arm was a bone knife. The lower end was sharpened to a point, and the knuckle at the other end was covered with the same woven cotton for a better grip. Black feathers hung from the top. He tapped one of the bones.
This is of my grandfather.
He touched the other.
This is of my father.
One day when I have a strong son, he will wear one of me and of my father, and the one of my grandfather will be put to rest in the ground.
When Kalin had first seen the bone knives, when they had left the mud people village, she had thought they were ceremonial. With terrible certainty, she now knew they were not. They were real weapons. Spirit weapons.
What are the feathers?
He stroked the glossy black feathers on the one at his right shoulder. The birdman we had then, when this was made, placed these. He touched the ones on his left shoulder. The birdman we have now placed these. They are raven.
The raven was a powerful spirit to the mud people. Its image invoked death.
While she thought the idea of wearing a knife made from your grandfather and father's arm bone was gruesome, she knew it was an honor to Chandelin, and so didn't say anything to insult his beliefs.
It brings me honor, Chandelin, that you would bring the spirits of your ancestors to protect me." He didn't look happy. "The Birdman says you are mud people too, and must be protected. So I wear these. It is my duty." He stroked his grandfather's bone again. "My grandfather taught my father, and my uncle, Tofalar, the man you killed, to be protectors of our people." He touched his father's bone. "My father taught me, and I will teach my son when he comes, and someday he will carry my spirit with him as he protects our people. Since the time we killed the Jacopo, we have not let many come into our land. Our ancestors' spirits teach us that to invite others to come as they wish is to invite death. The spirits speak true. You brought Richard with the temper to us, and because of him, Darkenrall came and killed many of our people." So it came down to this. Chandelin was supposed to be a protector of his people, but they had been killed, and he hadn't been able to stop it. "The ancestors' spirits helped us to save the mud people, Chandelin, and countless others. They saw that Richard's heart was true, that he was risking his life, the same as you, to save others who did not want war." "He stayed in the spirit house while Darkenrall killed our people. He did not try to stop him. He did not fight. He let our people die."
"Do you know why?"
She waited as he stood stone-faced. But when he didn't reply, she resumed. "The spirits told him that if he went out to fight Darkenrall, he would be fighting the way Darkenrall fought, and Richard would die, never to help anyone. They told him that if he wanted to defeat Darkenrall and save the rest of the mud people, he must not fight the way Darkenrall did, but wait and fight his own way later, just as the spirits told your grandfather." He regarded her skeptically.
"This is his story."
"I was there, Chandelin. I heard them say this. Richard wanted to fight. He wept with frustration when the spirits told him he must not. There was nothing that could have been done to stop Rawl just then. It was not Richard's fault, nor was it yours. You could have done nothing to stop it, the same as Richard could have done nothing. If he had tried, he would be dead and Darkenrall would have won." He leaned a little closer.
"If you had not brought him, it would not have happened. Darkenrall would not have come looking for him."
She drew herself up straight. "Chandelin, do you know what I do, what my specialty is?"
"Yes. Like all confessors, you make people afraid of you, so you may tell them what to do, and because they are afraid, they will do as you say."
"In a way. I lead the Council of the Midlands. I represent all the people and protect their rights. I make it possible for those like the mud people to live as they wish."
"We protect ourselves."
She gave him a sober nod. "You think so? For every one of the mud people, there were 5 Jacopo. Your grandfather was brave and defeated an enemy that outnumbered him. But for every man, woman, and child of the mud people, there are over 100 dead soldiers here, and this is only one city of this land. They were defeated, as if they were nothing. 100 fighting men for every mud person, and they fought bravely. You said